The Honorable, the Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit. Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having any manner or form of business before the Honorable of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit are admonished to draw nigh and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Mr. Cook.
I didn't want to do that.
Excuse me, Your Honor. May it please the court. Under the Fourth Amendment, police may act to protect the public and themselves from imminent harm. As the Supreme Court said in Brigham City, the role of peace officers includes preventing violence and restoring order, not simply rendering first aid to the casualties. Under the Fourth Amendment's reasonableness test, the critical question when you have as important a government interest as you do here is that you have an appropriately tailored response aimed at reducing the danger that is limited in its intrusiveness. And the steps the officers took to reduce danger here to the public and themselves was appropriately tailored and limited in its scope.
Counsel, can I ask you a question? It seemed to me, I guess, that the court in Terry already struck that reasonableness balance and so I guess I'm asking, is your position that as an appellate court, we can sort of look at all of the circumstances and kind of calibrate the balance on the facts of this case in a way different than what the court did in Terry?
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that is really a fundamental point about the doctrinal framework here. When you go to exigency analysis, the Supreme Court has said that this is a totality inquiry and that the factors that the court has used in creating doctrines like Terry, which is the factors you see in cases like Brown, and they come up in other cases, which is the importance of the government interest, the severity of the public intrusion on privacy, and the tailoring that has to occur. That test is employed in the exigency cases. And I think one of the clearest examples of that is a case cited in the majority opinion before the panel in this case, which is Illinois versus MacArthur, which is an exigency case. The facts are pretty removed from here. Illinois versus MacArthur is a case where the police discover that somebody in a trailer has evidence of drugs, and they hold the person outside while they go and get the warrant. And it's an exigency based on evidence destruction, which is pretty far removed from here. But analytically, what the court does in that situation is they, without citing Brown, but using those factors, apply them.
And but in this case, it's not just exigency that was used to decide this case. Special needs was added to it. And that wasn't argued below on appeal. Is it your position that exigent circumstances constitutes a special need? Or would you concede that the two doctrines are separate?
Well, I would say they're distinct doctrines for sure. But bear in mind that, as I was just saying, with the exigency doctrine, you're applying the general reasonableness test.
But
it would be surprising if looking to special needs, which is further application of that test, that you're going to have some kind of conflict, because the exigency test is the overarching reasonableness test applied to particular circumstances.
Counsel, can I just follow up and then I'll stop? But I mean, the court did apply the balance, the reasonable balance you're talking about in Terry, in a case that, unlike MacArthur, is exactly on point, because the concern there was that people were armed with guns and about to use them in public in the middle of the day in a crowded bank. And the court, looking at that particular exigency, people with guns about to use them, said, we understand this is an exigency, and therefore, with individualized suspicion, the police may take action. And so I am concerned, as a lower court judge, that you're asking me to sort of redo the court's work.
No, I don't think I'm asking you to redo the court's work, because the exigency test asks you to apply these general factors And what sets this apart from a typical Terry case, Terry is a case that's going to cover a huge range of offenses. It could be even jaywalking, far removed, whereas exigency asks you to look at the danger. And without a significant danger like you have here, it's going to be readily distinguishable.
Counsel, sorry,
it's over here. It's hard to tell.
doesn't Lidster give us that answer in the context of checkpoints? Because Lidster says, if it's a law enforcement purpose, like Terry, then we look at the Edmonds test and you have to do that. But if it's not a law enforcement, if it's a public safety issue, for example, as exampled in Lidster, then instead we don't look to the same analysis. We look instead to whether it is reasonable in light of no reasonable suspicion.
Isn't that the distinction
that's being drawn, that Terry applies in a traditional law enforcement role where the context we're talking about is not, it's a public safety issue, and Lidster tells us that that is different than the traditional law enforcement role.
Right. I mean, Lidster cites specifically Brown and applies it in a context-specific way, the factors. And it says, look, we're talking about a very serious crime. Somebody was hit and killed by a motorist. The person was on a bicycle. And it allows you to incorporate this very serious danger. I think another case that is very helpful to bear in mind when you're talking about danger as a critical conceptual piece of the analysis is the Supreme Court's opinion in Michigan versus Tyler, which is the fire case. You can have fires where the whole notion of criminal wrongdoing is absent. And the idea of particularization about a person who committed a crime is missing. And yet police or firemen can, of course, act. And to use an example, if the police were to enter a floor of an apartment building and there were 8 doors there, the hallway is filled with smoke, they wouldn't be in a position of saying, well, you know, we can't particularize it down to one apartment that might be the source of the fire, so we just can't do anything because the Fourth Amendment has protection, rightly so, of homes. They're entitled to act in that kind of a scenario, and it's just an application of this balancing. And why is that permitted? Well, because the...
Does that make it a checkpoint case, then? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think that... I think the critical thing to focus on here is when you go to apply the factors from Brown, and I keep calling it Brown, but there's so many cases from the Supreme Court that use this general balancing test that it's probably a misnomer to just call them Brown. But you're looking at the severity of the government interest, which is really high when you're talking about imminent loss of life. And then the degree of privacy intrusion. And sometimes in exigency cases, the privacy intrusion will be pretty high. And so the Supreme Court in its recent drunk driving cases has been wrestling with when you can do blood draws. And that's obviously a very intrusive step. And so the Supreme Court has reined in the circumstances.
Where is the indication of imminent loss of life here?
Well, it's a collection of facts. It's the 5 to 6 shots. They arrive within 35 seconds. While they're approaching, they don't see anyone. Then they see right with where they think the gunfire originated, 5 to 8 men within what
How do was... they know where the gunfire originated? Did they stop all? Did they stop everybody?
They stopped the 5 to 8 people out in the field.
And 5 to 8?
5 to 8 is what the...
Oh, I thought you said 5 to 6 a while ago.
I'm sorry if I...
I don't know.
But another really important fact here is when the officers arrive, they see somebody who they think is shot.
Did they go to render aid to that person?
They did. That was Officer Fitzpatrick. Officer Gaines was the one who, and O'Brien were the ones that interacted with the defendant.
Was he shot?
He was not shot, but the Supreme Court has said in a host of Fourth Amendment contexts that reasonable mistakes of fact are not sufficient to make police officer action
Does it make any difference that, unlike in Litzer, the officers in this case seem to hone in on particular individuals as opposed to stopping everyone within a defined area?
I think that that does become important in situations that are not an emergency situation. So, for example, the reasonableness test would permit, you know, everyone who comes into the court today goes through a metal detector. There's a degree of searching there that is permitted as a background balancing of reasonableness. And in that kind of a setting, the fact that it is applied in a general manner is important to the analysis. But when you're responding to a defined emergency, it's important that, and this really follows out of the tailoring requirement, out of the balancing test, that it be limited in scope and directed toward, you know, reducing the danger.
So anytime shots are fired, regardless of whether or not the officers know that shots are being fired at someone or there is actually an imminent threat, shots being fired is enough to just search anyone in the area?
No, that's in fact that would illustrate an error in applying the balancing test here. It's always
shots
the totality.
Fired in a particular area. If shots were fired out in the country without, and it's not a high crime area, then you don't get to search everybody. But if it's in a high crime area, that makes it more imminent.
I don't think it is whether it is out in the country or in the city is the distinction that matters. What matters is that the circumstances support the inference.
I thought you were using the high crime area to support you.
It matters here, but that's because you're always
here.
Looking
yeah,
at
yeah,
the,
you're here, you're talking about this was a high crime area. That's the reason the police officers were there, right?
Right, right. My point
would,
is
wouldn't
that
the analysis be the same if it was, let's say, a college campus or perhaps a place of worship? Right, as contrasted
Absolutely.
With, you know, a rural location where shots are often fired for very legitimate reasons. I mean, it's not that the rural city or high crime, non-high crime, but the context in which it occurs. If it's a place of worship, or if it is a university, or if it's a housing area, any of those would suggest to us that those shots are not being fired for legitimate reasons, right?
Exactly.
If that's the rule, and I take the point, why wouldn't a shopping center qualify? It seems to me it's wherever there are a lot of people.
Yeah, I think it's
your
more,
rule applies.
Yeah, I think it's more than that. The issue is, and this question I think really goes to the first factor, which is the strength of the government interest. You need to have sufficient evidence that people are in danger here.
Well,
and
if there are a lot of people in a shopping center, I mean, you're saying your rule wouldn't apply there?
No, what matters is not the particular location, but the collection of facts that lead you to the conclusion that people are in imminent danger.
Well, I thought in response to the question from my colleague, Judge Richardson, that you were making the distinction between the country, not people, and places where there were people. So all places where there are a lot of people, your rule applies?
No, I think the point here is that it is not the location. It is whether the particular facts and circumstances suggest that people are in imminent danger.
The facts are established. Shots are fired, and there are a lot of people. What else do you need?
What else do you need? Those are the particular facts.
Right. Well,
the particular facts. I mean, you're not going to see that. The facts were that there were 911 calls. There were five or six shots. The officers were within throwing distance of it. They got there in 35 seconds. There were people fleeing from it. They observed somebody who they thought had been shot, and they were in a high crime area. Now, when you have all of that, the officers could reasonably perceive there's danger.
Exactly.
And so we don't look at one fact and say that's automatically danger, or another fact and say that's automatically danger. You look at the totality and say, was this a dangerous situation?
Is that your answer to my question?
That is exactly right. And
so everything Judge Nehemiah just said is what we put into the calculus becomes your test, correct?
It's a totality test, as
the Supreme
Court said.
Everything that Judge Nehemiah said, that's your position, that's what it applies.
Right.
Okay. Was the person stopped running from the scene?
He was walking away, but that's...
He was walking away. He was, what do you mean walking away? He was walking home, perhaps. Away from what?
He was walking away from the location of the gunfire.
They don't know the location.
He was pointing back and said, I mean, by the time they stopped, the shots were over there.
And like a good citizen who's trying to help the police, I think he was trying to say, I'm checking on my nephew. Instead, they jumped on him rather than normally you would say, where was it, sir? Can I help you? You duck down. I'm going to help. Instead, like, he becomes the... What are you talking about he was running away?
All of the facts.
I saw the facts. We all saw the video. He wasn't. He was standing way over there, and he put his hand up. He said, over there. And everybody said, my nephew. And then by the time he saw his nephew, they're all over him. Him.
Right. The collection of facts here provided sufficient basis for the officers reasonably to conclude that the people on the scene were in danger. And
if we
once
were to
they
uphold
that,
the, if we were to uphold the district court here, what options would the officers then possess to defuse the situation? Assuming that we rule this kind of action off balance, what options are the officers left with to determine the danger and to defuse the situation, or is the only option really just to completely stand down?
The district court's conclusion was that what the officers should have conducted was a consensual encounter. And I think it's important to note that precedent has established that the kinds of circumstances here where the officers, the steps that they would take to try to protect themselves and control the scene, such as being assertive, having their weapons ready, those are steps that are by themselves going to start inching you toward a seizure anyway.
Is a consensual encounter a realistic way of dealing with this situation?
It is not, and I would point the court to a number of dangers that would arise.
What are the problems with taking a consensual encounter approach?
I think that among them are, first, hesitation by officers when they arrive on the scene of gunfire, where it's reasonable to conclude that the police and the public are in danger of imminent harm.
And it's very time-consuming, isn't it?
It is.
So to go individual by individual by individual and have a consensual encounter for every single time you ask someone to raise their hands. And so my concern is, if we rule this option out of bounds, do we leave the officers with any plan B or any kind of effective alternative other than to essentially stand down and wait and let another homicide occur? I mean, what if they can't do this, what can they do?
I think, and in answering Judge Wilkerson's question, answer the question, is that the issue in this case?
I think it is, because hesitation by the officers here can result in death and injuries to the other. The officers themselves could be killed by a lack of precautions.
Okay, but what about these people? What about these people who were walking along in the field? They weren't running, no furtive gestures, no reaching, no suspicious activity. What about them in particular gave the officers the right to seize them?
Well, I think that's a very important question. Excuse me, just let me finish if I could,
Mr. Cook. You've been talking about generalities and the fact that these shots were discharged on Walcott Place, some way over, lots of buildings in between, a field, and the officers were concerned. Good enough. But what about these people gave them the right to stop them? I haven't heard anything that these men were just walking along, minding their own business. They were coming from that area, but nothing about them suggested that they were armed and dangerous or involved in criminal activity.
Right, and that's where I think the tailoring part of the Brown factors is particularly important. And you're talking about a very limited intrusion, both in terms of visual inspection to figure out who is armed, which is key. The main thing the police can do to reduce the danger here and ensure that no one else is harmed, it is very short in duration. From the time the police step out of the police vehicle to when this defendant one of the officers says the gun is on him is about 1 minute. And after that, they are not detaining other people on the scene. So the scope of this intrusion is quite limited. And the tailoring is, I think, also important, that these people were ones who could pose a danger.
Why?
Wow.
Why you said these people were those who could. Why?
Right.
Why these people?
Well, because as they're approaching, they don't see anyone else around. The 5 to 8 men on the field are the ones that are in closest proximity to where they reasonably believe the shots originated.
Oh, I saw a person pass by in the foreground and moved on, and they went way to the background to get this guy across the field.
And does the record tell us that they're the closest people? That's what I couldn't understand.
So the record says that as they're approaching the scene, they do not see. So they get there within 35 seconds, but even before that 35-second point, they're looking at where they think the shots originated. And so they actually are gaining information about what's happening before they even get there. They get out of the car, and they see 5 to 8 people walking away from where they believe the shots are originating. They see the man who they think may be injured. And in order to make sure that there isn't further violence ensuing, where you've got somebody who even appears to have been shot, which certainly ratifies their sense that they are at the right location, they are then, let's find out who has a gun, which is a very limited and directly relevant.
But all of these Fourth Amendment cases come down in the end to a balance. And isn't the balance here a limited stop in the area of an active shooter situation on the one hand versus the prospect of another homicide on the other? And when you balance, nobody wants any infringement of any kind. I understand there's a privacy interest here, but when you balance a limited stop in the area of repeated gunfire against the prospect of another human being losing his or her life, where does the weight on the scale lie?
Is there anything in this record that tells us that somebody lost their life because of this gunfire?
No, but
Do we know that the defendant here was, in fact, the person that fired gunshots?
No, but, no. Your Honor, under cases like Hine versus North Carolina, the Supreme Court has reiterated that reasonable mistakes of fact are not a basis for saying.
I quite understand that. But earlier when we were talking about the facts, we wanted to be clear that we were, remember Judge Niemeyer's question, we wanted to be very clear we were talking about the facts of this case.
You say it's a limited intrusion. By limited in terms of what? What was limited by time?
It was limited by time and the scope. And
unfortunately, in this country, too many times, doesn't take much time for a stop, particularly an African-American male, to be fatal to them.
It doesn't take very long.
So when you talk about
it's
a minimal intrusion, that's relative, isn't it?
It is.
As you said, these people.
I would direct the court to Figg versus Schroeder, Judge King's opinion. And that was a case where a person was shot on the scene, and the court said, faced with the need to conduct their investigation of the shooting incident in a reasonably safe environment, the initial half-hour detentions of the Figgs constituted a measured and proportionate response. That was a group of 4 people who were related to the shot individual who the officers had a reasonable basis to believe could pose a danger.
So at least you had consanguinity to be connecting the small group of people.
They knew a person.
That's right, but they in this scenario, the police were responding to gunfire, 5 to 6 gunshots. It was in the dark.
In the problem, we're going to have to determine who are these people that the Fourth Amendment somehow is less than. Because that's the only thing I saw you said. These people there mean that you could search them. That's all you said, basically. You said these people are there. They weren't running. There was no indication of involving crime. Matter of fact, one person seemed to be trying to be helpful and said, listen, he pointed over there. And then instead, he's besieged because he was one of these people?
I think that it's important not to lose sight of what, as we pointed out in the record, a woman said right after the homicide that occurred 11 days earlier. She said, I have a young child. I live in this community. I don't want to be ducking bullets. The best way to try to address that concern is to have police respond quickly to shootings and protect people from gunfire. When the police do that, they need to be able to ensure that
this
people
wasn't a
there,
shooting. These were shots fired.
It was 5 to 6 gunshots.
Let me ask you on that, because I made this point in a previous case, and I think they ascribed it as though I was saying it, but I'm saying this arises naturally from the position you've taken. What you've said essentially is that there are circumstances here. Every one of them arise from the fact that there are shots fired, as Judge Backer just alluded to. And it doesn't matter that it's a high crime neighborhood, because you don't want to say people in a high crime neighborhood have less constitutional rights, as Judge Richardson said. You could be out in the open field. So it comes down to the essential fact you got 5 shots fired in a crowded area because they have guns. They have a right to have guns all over the country. And sometimes guns go off accidentally or go off voluntarily. What I understand you to say is you hear those, if officers get those gunshots, at that point, everybody in that whole area there then becomes subject to being searched or seized. That's correct, right? Under these circumstances, nothing else. You can go running to the scene, you can say it's night, all of that doesn't matter if there are not shots fired. The central fact here is there were 5 or 6 shots fired in a crowded area. Everything else, if you want to go to Judge Niemeyer, gave a litany of other things, but every one of those things arose from the fact that the shots were fired. 911 call, all of that came from shots fired. And anytime shots are fired, there's no injuries here. Nobody just knows. It just go up. What arises from this is you are subject to being searched. Doesn't matter where you live. Anybody walk around can be searched. Isn't that correct?
I would disagree in the following sense. Because the circumstances
here. How many of them were subject to being searched? If you couldn't search 5 to 8, how many could you search? You said you disagree with the 5 to 8. So how many could be searched? Three to four? How many 5 to 8 could you search?
My disagreement was not on number of people to be stopped and the degree of intrusion. My disagreement is here the facts that suggest that there is immediate danger to people on the scene are more than what Your Honor was describing.
That's really, you're really hitting on it right there. What are the facts beyond the fact there were 5 or 6 shots fire in a neighborhood? I mean, what are the facts? I mean, everything arises from that fact, does it not?
There is the man who appears to be shot that they reasonably believe.
After the shots are fired, which is what gets them in the neighborhood, he appears to be shot. He's not shot. And you know this before the other guys is searched, right?
No. By the time they figured out he's not shot, as I said, the detention of the defendant.
So someone holding their arm in an area. That's enough to, tell me, does it happen at that point? At that point, can you then do it?
It's always going to be a totality inquiry.
But is that the determinative fact then?
I don't want to get lost on a legal term, totality of the circumstance. I agree. Right. But totality of the circumstances has an underlying basis of fact. And all I'm asking you is, what are those facts? I know the law.
Right.
And so if the fact is there are 5 shots, a man is holding his arm, is that it? Is that the totality, or you got to keep getting more?
No, I think this reflects the kind of divide and conquer approach that the Supreme Court has repeatly said.
No.
This is the
Fourth Amendment, and it implicates Second Amendment rights. Everybody has a right to own a gun if you're doing it lawfully in certain places. Guns go off all the time. Now, I don't say they go off 5 or 6 times. It could happen. But you shoot a gun 5 or 6 times in any area, I want to know what then gives rise to be stopping everybody in that area. And all I'm seeing is if a guy's holding an arm, police rush there. If it's night at night and you can search, you can do this. What else did you take?
If there was a homicide here 11 days earlier,
so it does go back to the high crime area.
No, it's
so only in a high crime area if shots are fired, but not in rural West Virginia, a small town in West Virginia, where I do hear shots all the time fired, especially during hunting season.
No, what really matters is that a reasonable person considering all of the facts together, would conclude that there is an imminent danger. And I think that,
in other words, what you're arguing, as I understand it, is that it would not be an appropriate analysis to take an individualized fact, whether the gunshots or one person's injured or whatever, but to look in the circumstances and to see whether those circumstances provide a reasonable conclusion that there is danger afoot. And in this case, you had the high crime area, you had a homicide in the area, you had five or six shots, you had people in the community complaining on 911 calls pursuant to those shots. You arrive in the scene in 35 seconds. You have 5 to 8 people walking away from the location. You have one of them that looks injured, and the intrusion is simply a flashlight on the person and telling him to lift his shirt to see if there's a gun in the waistband.
That's exactly right. And
they
I
only
think
searched one person?
It arises from the fact that there were gunshots fired on that particular day. I'm not disputing anything Judge Niemeyer just said. I just want to be clear. Even a homicide happened 2 weeks or a year early in a neighborhood. I want to know what it is in a neighborhood, and it shouldn't matter that it's over in Creighton Court, which is a high crime area. Anybody, they're not second-class citizens over there. I want to know when you're in another area, there's a citizen who's walking on anywhere in the street where there are 5 or 6 shots being subject to the same kind of circumstance, because you can build up facts from that. You can have police run all over the place. You have yelling. Police were yelling and make it just as horrible as it can be. But it comes down to the fact there were 5 or 6 shots fired. Why don't you just admit, if you shoot a gun up 5 or 6 times, you just lose rights?
You do not just lose rights, but that's obviously a very important fact.
You assuredly do, as you do here. If you walk it anywhere around here and shoot up a gun 5 or 6 times, police go around searching on these streets right now, the same kind of thing will come up. They know they're shot. You got a courthouse near here. You got all these other circumstances. We can search them.
I want to go back to my original question. Are you basing your case on exigent circumstances or a combination of exigent circumstances first plus special needs doctrine?
No, I think that
which one?
The exigent circumstances doctrine covers this scenario.
Are you saying that exigent circumstances includes the doctrine of special needs?
What I'm saying is that the exigent circumstances doctrine requires you to apply the balancing test.
Forget balancing. I'm asking you what theory is your case. Is it based on exigent circumstances, special needs, or a combination of the two?
Exigent circumstances provides the balancing test that allows what happens here. You see that same balancing test.
You're not answering the question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, it's very simple. Is the doctrine of special needs included in your defense of this activity? Yes or no?
It is not, but it is not in that sense mutually exclusive.
No, we're not saying they're mutually exclusive. We just want to understand what the rationale here.
Right.
As I understood from your papers, your first reason was that there was no reasonable articulable suspicion. The district court rejected that, and you have abandoned that argument, right?
That's right.
Right. And your second argument was, no, we have exigent circumstances.
Right.
And is that the argument that you are proposing today?
That's right.
And you never have argued special needs. Is that right?
That's right, although I don't
think understand you think they're related.
Yeah.
But if we are purists, just give us that benefit of the doubt. The doctrine that the government asserts here requires this is exigent circumstances. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Thank you.
And I think that when you look at how the court has applied exigent circumstances, you see that the court is doing the kind of analysis that allows you to look at this, the degree of the danger, how tailored the response is, the level of intrusion on privacy interests, and perform a balancing.
Mr. Cook, can I ask a follow-up to what Judge Niemeyer described as, at least at first blush, a fairly compelling case perhaps for reasonable suspicion? And you just told Judge Motz that you had conceded that issue and you didn't think that the record, at least the government suggested the record didn't support it. And I want to go back to what Judge Harris earlier told you about, discussed with you about Terry. I mean, the reason we have Terry is to give officers a reason basis for wanting to stop or believing they can stop somebody to investigate. And as Judge Niemeyer has just described these facts, it seems like there was a case to be made there. You didn't make it. And getting back to Judge Wilkinson's question about the balance, it seems to me that once the officers arrive on scene, they have performed part of that duty to protect the public against a future prospective homicide. And then the balance begins to shift to the individuals who are being intruded upon. And you say these intrusions were minimal. That's all in the eye of the beholder. And that's what Terry is supposed to protect against. So why are you asking us to carve out what I believe to be a new rule of law when it seems like the tools at hand might have been sufficient?
I don't think we're asking the court to carve out a new rule. And exigent circumstances has always been available in situations where there is a danger or a risk of destruction of evidence, and that does not exclude, it doesn't go away when there may be criminal activity afoot. I think a good example of this and why exigency is important is, for example, the Palacios case out of the Second Circuit, where a showing that there in that case was individualized suspicion as to everyone who had been seized would really not be tenable.
But this case is different because you said that these individuals were coming from the area where the shots were fired, and so there's a narrowing that occurs as a result of that. That's not Palacios.
That's exactly right, and I think that that's an important point. We're not saying that the police could have seized people who were not in a location where they could pose an immediate danger to people. And so this is not Dragnet.
You're saying you couldn't search all eight of them?
No, all eight could be stopped, and those who were stopped and showed their hands and convinced the police officers there in the dark that they did not have a gun were immediately let go, and they kept going about their business because the officers had been assured that to a sufficient degree that they were not a danger to the people.
How many guns did they find?
They found the gun on the defendant.
Billy Curry.
Right, and they may have found
one
more.
Gun. Now, did they stop after that one gun?
That's right, and if you look
at that was the end of it.
That was the end of it.
So they assumed that nobody else had a gun? There was only one gun. One gun, and we stopped.
And they may have been wrong in that, but that was a cautious Fourth Amendment approach.
Well, there were 5 to 8 shots. There could have been 5 to 8 guns.
There could have been multiple shooters.
It might be a cautious Fourth Amendment approach, but it wasn't an approach that protected the public, which is what this is certainly all about.
It was an approach that they thought reasonably balanced the level of intrusion against what was needed to protect the public.
But there's only intrusion of one person now and one gun.
Right, but it would be a...
And since they're going to make, as I understand from your argument, very unobtrusive approaches to the various people that could keep on making these unobtrusive approaches.
No, I don't think that's...
Because there were multiple shots.
I don't think that's right. I think that having arrived on the scene, tried to control it in a brief amount of time, that if the danger at that point had abated, for them to have said 5 minutes later, you over there, stop,
I thought this was all going on simultaneously.
It was. The power under exigent circumstances would disappear fairly quickly, I think, because the danger, this court could say, had abated at that point.
Articulable suspicion?
Right. At that point, you might be in
you
the
found
realm.
A gun on one person in the field. Why not the other? That would increase your reasonable articulable suspicion, wouldn't it?
Well, then you would be more in the nature of like case like Ibarra from the
Supreme Court.
Well,
sometimes they're shooting at each other. That's right. The first one shooting
The
fact you find one gun and increases, as Judge Mott said, answers that there's more than one.
If they stop somebody and he said, yeah, actually there was a dispute between the guy in the blue jacket and the guy in the red shirt and they were shooting
each
other.
Did the gun they found, was it found loaded?
Your Honor, that's not in the record. I could tell you the answer.
Well, I know it's not in the briefs, or it's not in the, at least in a, I looked at their two opinions before I came in here to try to see that. It's not in there anywhere. So it's right. not in, didn't come out at the hearing?
No.
Nobody knows whether it was floated or not.
Well, it's known, but it's not in the record, Your Honor. I'm not going to tell you.
Well, that's what I'm getting at. Counsel, I appreciate it.
Can I give you a chance to address a concern that has sort of arisen for me as you've been dealing with these questions? So the court in Terry thought it was very important that police officers have clear rules that could guide them when they were in the field like this. And at first I thought you were asking this court to do sort of an ad hoc reasonableness balance in a way that was different than the way the court did it in Terry. But now it sounds you're suggesting every police officer in the field is going to do rough and ready Fourth Amendment reasonableness balance every time they make a decision. Isn't that precisely what the court was trying to avoid in Terry, that you don't leave it to officers in the field to figure out, hang on, I'm thinking about the Brown balance, and I think I can stop this guy, but not this guy, even though there were five shots. That's how you get into this mess that we're having right now. What's wrong with just going with Terry rule, which is designed precisely for situations where the police have reason to believe there is a gun that presents an imminent danger to the public? And I will just add, the last time I heard a conversation a lot like this one, it was at oral argument in the JL case, where the court was asked to make an exception to Terry for gun cases because guns were so dangerous and it was so hard for police to do consensual encounters or otherwise address the dangers posed by guns. And the court explained in the case, we already did this in Terry. We're not doing it, and Terry is the rule for guns. So.
Right. And the point I think that Your Honor is missing in that description of the doctrine is that the Supreme Court has expressly, in the context of exigent circumstances, said we're doing this balancing. And that is not a surprising result because exigent circumstances, you're dealing with a scenario that is inherently about improvisation. It is an emergency situation. And what drives us home, I think, and shows you how doctrinally this fits with what the Supreme Court is doing is look at the use of force cases. The use of force cases ask you as a starting proposition that the officer has to take into account the danger of the offense. You don't get to use a use of force for possession of marijuana. You, absent more, you need to know exactly what the Brown balancing test asks you about. The degree of the government interest, the severity of the intrusion, and how well it's tailored. And so exigency, it should not be a surprise, ends up working similarly to uses of force. These are just scenarios where the police have to have latitude, and you bear the price of a doctrine that has less clarity at the starting point. And I think that when you're talking about police response to imminent danger,
you don't agree with the suggestion that Terry somehow eliminated the exigency doctrine. In other words, they really addressed two completely distinct circumstances. Under one, if the officer has reasonable suspicion that somebody is committing a crime or has committed a crime, he can allay that suspicion, particularized suspicion. But in the exigent circumstances doctrine, the officers can address the public safety in circumstances where it acts in a tailored response to the safety until it dissipates or, as you say, in this case, the exigency basically subsides. But these are highly factual circumstances, and I gather your whole argument here is that in all the circumstances that faced these officers that night, they concluded that there was a dangerous circumstance, and they responded to it by picking 5 to 8 people who were walking away from the scene and simply asking them to show their waistbands to see if they had guns. And one of them happened to have a gun, and he's charged with that independently. But the question is, was that response a tailored response to the danger, not to a particular suspicion of a person?
Exactly, and I would go back.
Okay, may I mention one thing?
Sure.
I'm concerned about the fact that you keep talking about the circumstances as a general proposition, but they only really had evidence that there may have been a misdemeanor committed. Did they not?
Discharging a
firearm in a public place in the Commonwealth of Virginia is a Class 1 misdemeanor. They did not have any other evidence that anything other than a misdemeanor had been committed, did they?
Oh, that, I think, completely drops out the
Well, I'm
the
just
shot.
Interested in how that affects your analysis, because discharging a firearm is a Class 1 misdemeanor.
And a firearm can kill a person, right?
That's right. And the person who appeared to be shot gave the officers plenty of reason to believe that something more serious was afoot. I think that if any one of us had been in that police car.
I asked you earlier. Been going around forever about that. This is about the firearm. If you own up to it, I'm okay with it. But just recognize this all comes from Class 1 misdemeanor, as Judge Niemeyer said, it can kill a person. Well, that's what this is about. It's about shooting in a neighborhood. All these other facts are facts that arise from running around, yelling. The fact that it's a person killed 11 days ago just makes it a high crime neighborhood. We already said we're not going to hang our hat on that because that would make them second-class citizens. So it's about shooting shots in a neighborhood. And if that's the case, just say it.
Well, certainly
we can dance with all these other facts, get cute with things like totality of circumstances and apply them restrictly and selectively to various neighborhoods. And then we go in another neighborhood, and all of a sudden get religion again, and we go back and say the Fourth Amendment means what it means. Say what it says. 5 or 6 shots in a neighborhood means you then are going to lose some rights.
Ms. Cook, I'm going to let you respond to Judge Wynn, and then we're going to finish. Go ahead. No, sure. Respond to Judge Wynn.
No question. The 5 to 6 gunshots are a very important fact here. But it is also the case.
If you take that fact out, you wouldn't be here, correct? If you take that fact out, they wouldn't have gone there. You wouldn't have anything. That is the fact. It may be that you say you can't parcel things out, but you can add a bunch of nothing facts and you're still going to get nothing. And to make it sound all good to say you got all these other things here. But the fact is there were 5 or 6 shots. And without that fact alone, it wouldn't happen. That's all I'm saying.
Right. If this had been a report about a fistfight or a stabbing, it would be a different, very different scenario. But the other facts are really important, and you don't view one fact in isolation. That's the way totality
works. Important
if
you want to reach the result that is here, because then you got to build up on something. You don't want to say it. But what you ought to just own up to what it is. It is the fact of 5 or 6 shots being shot in a neighborhood. That's it. Once you get there, we can have a whole bunch of facts. I can make up every one of these facts every time 5 or 6 shots are made. I can find you a bunch of other facts to go with it and call it totality circumstances, but it really is 5 or 6 shots.
I would disagree with the latter part of that. I do think that the 5 or 6 gunshots are very important, but I would not treat the other facts as irrelevant, and I think it's not true that they're always going to arise.
Agree.
But my time is...
Agree.
Thank you, Mr. Cook.
Thank you.
Ms. Platt.
Good morning, Your Honors. Sorry. Morning. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm yes. Caroline Platt on behalf of Appellee Billy Curry. If I may start by noting, this case is about the suspicionless seizure of a person, and here's the bright line rule. The suspicionless seizure of a pedestrian is unconstitutional. I'd like to make 3 preliminary points in response to my friend from the U.S. Attorney's Office's argument.
Can I just address right here at the outset, because you've announced a direction you're going, which is basically the Terry analysis. And the government is not relying on Terry at all. The government's relying on the notion that there was a dangerous situation threatening the public safety. And that is a totally different doctrine. And so I hope you keep that in mind and don't take us down. We all know Terry very well.
But my next point, Your Honor, was about to be about the exigent circumstances doctrine, which my friend has now...
Well, I'm focusing more is not just the doctrine. It's the fact that the the officers and the government now are relying on a dangerous situation threatening the public safety. And the question is, under the reasonable standard, did the officers respond appropriately? And that is not a Terry situation, and it doesn't raise the Terry issues under the Fourth Amendment. Fourth Amendment is simply reasonableness.
Well, so, Your Honor, as I said, my colleague has now confirmed Terry is waived, and so is special needs. This is an exigent circumstances case solely. The only question...
Now, I don't agree with the last one from what he said. If special needs is something that has a similar type of analysis. His suggestion is that exigency is the best fit and under finding reasonableness. And so that it seems to me it's much more fruitful if you're going to answer the government is to point out that this was not a dangerous system to the public safety in these circumstances, or that it wasn't properly tailored, or the response was too intrusive.
If I may, Your Honor, the government misapprehended the law in two respects specifically to that point. The first one is that in the exigent circumstances cases, I counted 7 since Brown versus Texas was decided. I can list them if you like. The Supreme Court has never cited Brown v. Texas in any of its exigent circumstances cases since Brown was decided in 1979. If you want me to list them, I can, or I can file a letter tomorrow. They are Brigham City, Welsh.
Well, does that mean now the police officers, because they've never cited it, police officers can ignore dangerous circumstances in the community which threaten the public safety? In other words, because they don't have an individualized suspicion of a particular person, yet they know there's an enormous danger facing the public. They have no ability to respond except under the Brown doctrine.
No, Your Honor, I'm talking about my colleague's misapprehension of the law. I'm not talking about the police officer's actions. And so, as I said, I believe that Mr. Cook misstated the law, and I'm trying to help the court recognize that.
I want to get to the...
I'm sorry.
Just to clarify, I want to make sure I understand. I thought, and he can say this when he gets back up, I guess. I thought I heard him say that the court did not cite Brown, but actually used the Brown factors. Is that correct?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. My understanding and my recollection is that when the Supreme Court uses the Brown factors, which it does, those are the special needs cases, not the exigent circumstances cases.
And those special needs cases are cited and relied upon by the government in its briefs.
Yes, but they have now confirmed, and it has always been my understanding, that certainly at the district court, they are only relying on exigent circumstances. And if you look at the Supreme Court's case in Giardinello and also in Stiegold, the United States as the appellant cannot rely on new exceptions on appeal, and especially when that appellant is the United States government. The Supreme Court has noted explicitly that the United States cannot add new Fourth Amendment exceptions on appeal.
It was in the appellate brief.
Right. So, but it was not in the district court brief that they relied solely on the exigent circumstances exception, and my colleague confirmed that today. And so back to, as I was saying, the Brown versus Texas test goes to special needs and not exigency.
May I ask you a question? What are the officers supposed to do in this kind of situation? I mean, what options do they have in order for individualized suspicion to arise? It struck me that the most likely situation for individualized suspicion to arise was for another crime to occur or for another homicide to occur. Because a homicide and a crime, you know, evidence emerges from the commission of a crime. So is the option here that you're leaving the officers with to sit back and stand by, await the commission of another crime, await the commission of a homicide, which they'll be even closer to, and that will provide the individualized suspicion?
Certainly not, Your Honor. And I have seen, and I know Your Honor has seen, many, many, many Terry stops upheld where a crime was not committed and the crime was not witnessed. There's furtive gestures, nervous behavior,
but I mean,
how is
the individualized suspicion to come about?
Well, again, Your Honor, everyone in this room sees these cases every day where just in the course of talking to and or just observing people, police officers gain reasonable suspicion under Terry without a crime being committed. There's dozens, if not hundreds, of cases that this court sees every day that happens.
Excuse me a minute, but they're going to conduct interviews? I mean, most of those Mendenhall cases were situations where there was no emergency and where an officer approached an individual on the street in Mendenhall and said, are you willing to talk? And they're proceeding at a leisurely pace. But these people here, these officers here, are under intense time pressure. And they don't have time to just sit by and talk. And then if someone's nervous, that's not going to be enough because people are going to say, well, anybody would be nervous in a situation in which the police are talking to them. So I don't understand how they get individualized suspicion in a situation where all the alternatives are immensely time-consuming. Getting consent consent person by person by person, that takes time. Having an individualized conversation, that takes time. They're operating in an emergency here.
Well, so, Your Honor, as I said, under Florida versus Royer and many other cases, police-citizen encounters, well, frankly, have been the law before the government requested this new application or exception. So you have that. They could find the 911 callers who are clearly willing to talk to them. They could look at cameras. They could talk to security guards. They could look for physical evidence. And they could gain the reasonable suspicion that, frankly, is not a very high bar to gain. This is what the police have been doing for the 52 years since Terry.
Yeah.
It's not that difficult
do I understand,
to gain reasonable suspicion if you're the police.
Ma'am, do I understand that your argument comes down to the fact that if they don't have reasonable suspicion for a particular person in this case, they can't do anything?
That is not my position, Your Honor.
Well, that's the same. That's what you're leaving me to believe. In other words, these officers did not have individualized suspicion because they were confronting a dangerous circumstance. And so the question, the facts to them presented what they call a dangerous to public safety. So they do not know any given individual who could have committed that. At least they could not satisfy Terry. And so the question is, if they can't satisfy Terry, do they just have to sit and wait for a crime to occur?
I think, Your Honor, that's exactly...
I know, but you're sitting there constantly talking about, well, arguing that they do need the individualized suspicion, and I'm suggesting to you, if they don't have it, tell me what the officers can do.
So I think I just listed 8 or 9 things to Judge Wilkinson that they can do. There's only one thing that they cannot do, which is violate the Fourth Amendment.
Tell me what they can do. I want to know how they address this danger.
So,
how do they come in under the facts of this case where we have a shooting in a neighborhood where there had been a homicide before? There were 911 calls that night complaining about it. They're 35 seconds away. They know exactly where it came from. They drive up 35 seconds there and they see 8 people walking away in the field in front of them from the scene that they believe occurred. And they stop these people and see if they've got a gun. Now,
Your Honor,
they didn't have suspicion of any one of the 8. They didn't have any suspicion of one of the 8, but they were just basically trying to address the public safety concern. And you're saying they can't do that because they didn't have suspicion.
Some of the facts you just described are contrary to the record. I just want to note that I'm not conceding that those are the facts on the ground in this case. For example, the factual finding of the district court is that the officers did not know where the shots came from with any precise location. It was a vicinity.
I thought so,
page
too,
275
yeah.
of the joint appendix.
They drove up the field. They heard the shots, and they drove up the field. They were 2.5 blocks away, and they got there in 35 seconds. So they didn't have precision as to what apartment, but they knew it came from Walcott direction, and that
general vicinity.
General vicinity,
but not location.
I know, but that doesn't diminish the dangerous circumstance.
But Your Honor, in that there's no reasonable suspicion as to Mr. Curry, who's the only person whose rights are at issue in this litigation, Mr. Curry is not a danger to them because Mr. Curry is not suspicious.
We don't know that. We don't know that. He's at the scene and he's walking away from the location. And they see 5 to 8 people, a limited class of people walking away, and one of them seems to be injured. This is what the officers observed.
So this is another finding of the district court. There was no reason. The court found that it was quite likely that there were other people that were just equally known on the other side of the building that could have walked the other direction.
Of course,
driven away.
But that focuses on individual suspicion. I'm suggesting to you they don't have to go around and identify which person is in danger or not. They're trying to address the public safety in a reasonable manner. But now, if you say they didn't act reasonably, they should have stood there and watched.
And as I've listed many things they could have done, the only thing they cannot do is seize a calm, peaceable pedestrian without suspicion,
but
because that's a violation
things,
of the Fourth
Ms.
Amendment.
Pratt, all the many things you think they could have done, they all take an enormous amount of time. And the Supreme Court has always recognized that when you really have dangerous situations or exigent situations, that there is actually some flexibility in the Fourth Amendment rules, because it derives from the reasonableness at the heart of that amendment. You take a case like Warden v. Hayden, which was written by Justice Brennan, who is as eloquent a champion of Fourth Amendment rights as anyone I know. And he said, normally you don't enter a house without a warrant. But he said the exigency of the situation requires flexibility in the rule. Now, there was suspicion in that case. I know, I grant you. But the point I'm making with respect to Warden is that the exigent circumstances allowed the officers to proceed, even though it's as fundamental as anything to the Fourth Amendment that you have to get a warrant to enter a home. And here in Warden, they did not have a warrant, and the court says, all right, exigent circumstances, they don't need one.
If I may, Judge Wilkinson, this is one of the first point I wanted to make is this. The exigent circumstances exception has excused the need for a warrant, as you know, to enter a home in several cases and in the paradigmatic examples. But no application of the exigent circumstances exception has ever excused the need for suspicion. In every case, there's some version of particularized suspicion. There is no suspicionless exigent circumstances case that has excused police action by the Supreme Court or this court. Ever.
But the court has suggested that.
I want to follow up the question, because it seems to me, following the line of questioning here, I'm not totally disagreeing with where it's going. Someone goes in front of this courthouse, shoots five or six shots at people out there. Someone got killed 2 weeks ago out there. And police officers come in and know where the shots come. Why come they can't search everybody on that street? I mean, who are walking around? We know that people own guns. You have concealed weapon permit. I got that. I mean, the whole bit. There's guns all over the street. If you would stop, you'd find guns everywhere out there on that street, because ownership is guns is something we do. And that's okay. That's legal. But to fire the shots, as Judge Keenan pointed out, that's a misdemeanor. And once you fire those five or six shots, why in the world can they not stop you? Because these officers are looking out for their safety. The public safety is at aim. I could get shot if they don't do this. Why not?
The only answer I have to that question, Your Honor, is that because there is no...
Because it's no different than that crime area over there. I want to make sure that's clear, because the crime, we just don't want to make people who live in Creighton Court second-class citizens because they happen to live in a crime area. And I don't want people who walk around feel like they're going to be searched just because they live there as opposed to another area. So put it in front of this courthouse, the same thing. And I must agree, I don't understand why the public safety is not implicated in that instance for officers to stop and just search people. It's a simple thing.
Well, the Supreme Court has never recognized such an exception, and it's never happened, Your Honor. But I do agree, whatever rule the court chooses, whether this court or the Supreme Court, it's going to apply in front of the courthouse and in downtown Falls Church just as equally as it does in Creighton Court, as it should.
How do these five or six shots...
It applies to everywhere, not just over to Creighton Court.
Yes, sir.
That's the important thing. Everything is going on here. If we take out Creighton Court, since it can happen anywhere, in front of this courthouse, doesn't matter.
I agree,
Your Honor. How do these five or six shots... My good friend suggests, it may have well have been a misdemeanor. Is that really realistic that in a crowded area, you're firing five or six shots middle of the night? That's a misdemeanor, and it's not just a high crime area. You have the objective fact that a homicide has been committed within the past 10 days or 2 weeks, and you have a history of homicides here. And those are objective facts. Homicides, it's an objective fact that it's a crowded area. we can, I assume, take judicial notice of the fact that these were not cap guns that fired the shots. They were live bullets. And can we take judicial notice of the fact that bullets kill people?
I don't think we can. Totally agree with Judge Wilkinson on these guns. I think he's right. He's right, and that's exactly where I'm going with it. And I also would add, I don't think he means to say that if there's a homicide committed, that those citizens in that area become second-class citizens either.
Homicides are
committed all over the place.
Actually, the citizens in that area called in to complain. They wanted to be protected like every other citizen.
So, Your Honor, the fact
when you get calls from a place of high crime, that happens all the time. People are calling because it's high crime. They're calling all the time, not just for this.
So if their Fourth Amendment rights are suspended because there's a recent crime in a place where there's a high crime area, those citizens will have Fourth Amendment rights less frequently than the people who live in a different neighborhood, which I think is troubling at best. I would say the court and the Supreme Court has noted that the fact that a crime has been committed nearby, for example, in Wardlaw, or presence in a high crime area, is not suspicion. And as I noted, the accident circumstances...
Why don't they just move out of there? If they don't want to be in the area of high crime, they know their rights could be down. If you fire a gun, you're going to lose rights in there. Then I guess the implication is, why not just move out?
I think there's complicated socioeconomic and historic reasons for that, Your Honor. That's way beyond the record.
Go back to the example, if you would, that Judge Wynn gave you, because I wasn't sure of your answer. Someone's outside the courthouse now. Mm-hmm. They fire five or six shots.
Yes.
Same facts generally as we have in this case. Capitol Police and the Richmond Police get there in 30 seconds. They have all these folks out on the street. There was no murder here 2 weeks ago that I know of. So is there a Fourth Amendment violation when the police officers start to search the people on the street in that vicinity?
Yes. I mean, there's no – this is another point I'd like to note. The burden is on the government to justify a warrantless seizure or search, and they have to show that it falls within a well-delineated and recognized exception to the Fourth Amendment. There is no case that I'm aware of that has allowed for the dragnet suspicionless seizure or search of individuals for being in the vicinity of a crime, even within a minute of the crime. You need reasonable, articulable, individualized and particularized suspicion under Terry and its progeny, under Cortez, under Florida versus JL, I mean, under a litany of cases that rule would overrule.
Can I ask you a hypothetical? If a officer see a robber run from a bank, he mm-hmm. has just shot somebody in the bank and he's mm-hmm. taken the money and he mm-hmm. hops on a bus,
mm-hmm.
and the bus has eight other people on mm-hmm. it, the officer gets on his phone and mm-hmm. tells a police officer, stop that bus up mm-hmm. ahead, and describes the bus with a number.
Mm-hmm.
Police officers stop the bus, and they come on the bus, and they have eight people there, one of whom is the bank robber who shot somebody.
Yes.
How do they handle it?
So, Your Honor, that is a distinct legal issue from the one presented here.
I'm not asking you that. I said, yeah. How do officers handle that? Just stick with that question.
Right, I am. So that is what lawyers are starting to call a group reasonable suspicion case, or somebody referred to it as a murder on the Orient Express case, because you know that one person in a group is the one criminal you
see. Isn't that Palacios? Isn't that what happened in Palacios?
Yes, it is. Although Palacios, I think they seized 170 people, which is a much broader group. But yes, it is. And so I just, before somebody says that I've conceded something, I'd like to know, in this
case,
what
does the Fourth Amendment allow the officer to do?
So I just, again, I'd like to know before I get accused of giving away my case, that in this case, Judge Locke found that there was no reason to believe that any of the men in the field were the shooter.
Just stick with my question and answer what your understanding of the Fourth Amendment, what would the officers be allowed to do in that circumstance?
I think in that case, there is certainly reasonable suspicion that
of all eight?
Well, and in your case, they have a description of the shooter, or the robber, which I think is good.
No, they just say he got on the bus.
Well, but they saw him leave the bank, right? So they know what he looks like.
I'm saying there's no subscription. The guy ran in there. You can say, okay, he had a knapsack and he had a coat and a hat.
Right, so he would be identifiable.
But the other eight on the bus have a knapsack and a coat and a hat.
Well, so it is just like Palacios, Your Honor, where they had an eyewitness who was going to be able to say when they did, this was a show-up in Palacios, they had an eyewitness that said, that's the stabber.
Absent identification, you're saying they couldn't do anything. They have to let the bus go, right?
I haven't briefed that case because it's not the issue in this case.
Well, certainly they could ask. They could talk to everybody.
Right. And they would
there's
gain
no
suspicion.
Fourth Amendment violation. And they could have talked to the people here.
Exactly.
And often when police talk to people, then the people look nervous or they reach for their gun or they look over their shoulder, or they do something that creates a reasonable, articulable suspicion.
Exactly, Judge Motz, that's not
my hypothetical. My hypothetical is on the bus, and my question is, could the officers briefly pat down each one to find which one had the gun?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor, because under Robinson, this court's en banc decision, your seizure has to be legal before your frisk is legal. That's the rule in the circuit. And so, I haven't thought about that case.
Question on that same kind of thing when you were going into Terry. He says, you look and see if they're furtive. You see if there are other things that would allow that. Judge Wilkerson, and this is not a bus. But if you get on a bus, you got that limited opportunity with eight people. You can take your time and look at their faces and see if there's something that
again. And then you would gain your suspicion, which again happens a lot.
Unduly subjective, and we already have cases indicating correctly, in my view, that the fact that someone's nervous in the face of a traffic stop, that doesn't create a kind of suspicion to undertake a stop and a frisk or even more intrusive measures. But let me ask you one thing, because I'm interested in how the Fourth Amendment intersects with the democratic prerogatives, and it seems to me that this case raises that question. Richmond at the turn of the century had an alarmingly high homicide rate. And in response to that, the city government adopted a more proactive police strategy. And from the year to particularly as the proactive strategy went into practice, from the years 2004 to 2011 or 12, the homicide rate dropped substantially. Not as far as we would like to see it, but there was a measurable drop, and certainly the proactive policing was one among several factors that I believe would fairly contribute to it. Now,
Judge, what
if you say...
I'm sorry, Judge, what were the years you gave that?
What?
When the drop of the crimes, what years were they in Richmond?
I think they were from about 2004 until about 2011 or 12. And then it's kind of leveled off, but at a lower level than it was at the turn of the century. Now, the question I have is, if you say, as you are inviting us to say in this case, that even the most minimal intrusion in an active shooter situation is forbidden, you are striking at the heart of Richmond's proactive policing policies. And what you're doing is you're restricting the right of these communities to self-governance, not without restriction, to be sure, but to adopt within a limited range a strategy of proactive policing that have helped to reduce this terrible toll in the cities of taking human lives, each one of which has dignity. And you're leaving communities progressively more helpless to deal with unfortunate conditions that plague us all. And I think you're pushing the Fourth Amendment to a point where it really begins to infringe on democratic self-governance. And the latitude that cities should have, within reason, it's not unlimited, to adopt a strategy of proactive policing, which has proved effective in many, many places, and particularly in Richmond. And that's a tension you've got to grapple with.
So, Your Honor, I can't speak to Richmond Police Department crime statistics that I'm not aware of and that are not in the record. However,
but he is fundamentally correct. If you didn't have a Fourth Amendment, you wouldn't have to worry about this stuff. You could go in and search anybody, any place.
And
historically, as you said, before this country got the Fourth Amendment, that was what was happening.
And the Supreme Court.
And so he's saying we need to kind of go back to that era before we didn't have a Fourth Amendment.
And I would add, Your Honor, you know, the Supreme Court has said repeatedly that the fact that police work may be made more efficient does not dispense with the Fourth Amendment.
That's really not persuading me. You,
And Your Honor, I mean, the Fourth Amendment and the Constitution are the supreme law of the country, regardless of the Richmond City Council's desires.
If a Democratic governor, if a Democratic government has a strategy of policing that is working and that is responding not just to willy-nilly searches, these are not police on the rampage, these are police engaging in an active shooter situation in the area where the active shooting was occurred, the intrusion being minimal. If even that is wrong, what options and what choices do Democratic duly elected governments have left?
They can comply with the Fourth Amendment as interpreted by the Supreme Court.
They can raise their hands and let the homicide rate just return to where it was.
So can I ask you a question? I want to go back to, I think it was Judge Wynn's original hypothetical where the shots are fired in the street outside the courthouse. And I thought Judge Wynn said, can the police go into that street and seize everyone? And I actually think that would be a very different case. If the police went into that street and seized everyone, then we'd be over in that footnote to, I can't remember if it was Lidster or the one before it, but, you know, about whether the police can throw up a roadblock and without exercising any discretion, seal off an area. I think that's what happened in Palacios too. Mm-hmm. And it's what would happen in the bus. We're sealing off this area. We are not exercising discretion. We are mm-hmm. stopping everyone. Then you're more over in the special needs bucket. And there are still questions, I understand, about whether you can do that for a law enforcement purpose,
right.
But at least you have the basic, you're within the special needs Brown balance that says that kind of a stop is less intrusive because it's less concerning to the citizen, less frightening, you can see it happening to everyone, and you've taken police discretion out of the equation. But that didn't, so that's another alternative that might be available to the Richmond police or any other police, but that's not what happened here, right? I thought the district court made specific factual findings that in addition to the men in the field, there were people closer to the apartments where the police believed the shots to come from, but they didn't try to stop everybody. They made discretionary decisions about which among the citizens on the field would have to give up their, would have to suffer this particular intrusion. And the police got to decide which ones it was on the field. And I thought that made this, the Supreme Court says, that makes that kind of a stop much more intrusive than the kind you would have if you just sealed off both ends of a block and stopped everyone.
So I agree with everything you just said. And
so that would have been okay.
You accept that.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, so you don't even believe that's true, do you?
So Judge Harris just gave a very good description of my outline of the special needs aspect of this case, which didn't get into yet. But Your Honor, I think I have the list of six factors. The first special needs checkpoint that was okay was Martinez Huerte. And on, if you want, pages 559, they list six things about that checkpoint that made it okay. It wasn't just the international border part. And in SITS, which was the Michigan commission that set up the drunk driving one, they listed similar things that made that checkpoint okay. In Prowse and in Edmond, those are the two where they were like discretionary checkpoints or more like spot checks that were not okay for the exact discretion reasons that Judge Harris was just speaking to.
But those are all, aren't those all cases where there's more time? I mean, here this is almost simultaneous to the shot being fired. You only have a couple of officers. They think there's somebody shot. I don't see how they have the luxury of deliberating. Do we set up a checkpoint here? Are we going to get an additional 20 officers in here? It doesn't seem to me realistic to draw those conclusions from situations that are very factually different from what we have in this case at the moment this individual was seized.
Well, so, and again, Your Honor, I believe now my colleague from the U.S. Attorney's Office has now conceded that this is not a special needs doctrine case, it is correct. And part of the special needs analysis that the Supreme Court upholds is that these checkpoints are established in advance to avoid the discretionary problems. And that's why this isn't a special needs case. It's a mismatch doctrinally. The only ones that are set up sort of more on the fly are from circuits, not the Supreme Court and not this circuit, and they're the sort of bank robber cases. But those cases have particularized suspicion because they all involve GPS trackers on the money, which is so far afield from this case as to, I think, not.
But isn't that inconsistent with the idea, and I understand that maybe there's an issue, but Edmonds seems to say it's not always true, right? And that's followed up in Lidster. It says where you've got this public safety, it doesn't have to be every route that a terrorist could take. It's a likely route that a terrorist would take. That both the Supreme Court in Edmond and Lidster say you can make those stops without suspicion. I mean, the Supreme Court in Lidster says certain forms of police activity, like public safety, do not require suspicion.
So in Edmond, the holding in Edmond is the checkpoint in Edmond is unconstitutional. In Lidster,
but but you and I have talked about the language before, before I think you sort of said it was dicta, and maybe it is. But the language in Edmond says very clearly that a fleeing suspect or a potential terrorist that law enforcement without suspicion can put up a stop, not a programmatic stop. Right. But specifically for that felon, specifically for that attack.
Well, again, Your Honor, there's some version of suspicion. And if I can address Lidster, I'd really like to address Lidster. Lidster refers to the Edmond rule as a presumption of unconstitutionality. And Lidster, the reason that the checkpoint in Lidster was OK, there's two primary reasons. The first one dealt very strongly with the government interest in regulating motorists and highway safety, which is not at issue here, obviously. The second one is equally as important, I think, and again, highly relied on by the Supreme Court. The checkpoint in Lidster was acceptable because they were not seeking to investigate the people they stopped. It was start an encounter with motorists to seek information about other people. It was akin to starting a voluntary encounter, but with a car. The only way to do that is to stop the car.
But it analogizes that information gathering to public safety. I mean, it says, yes, that's information gathering, but Lister says that's the equivalent of a public safety rationale.
And so with a pedestrian, Your Honor, the equivalent of that, as it says this in Lister, is a voluntary police citizen encounter, not a seizure. So there's nothing about Lidster that makes the stop of Mr. Curry legal.
Your view is Lidster's just limited to cars, that it doesn't apply to
it relies very heavily, yes, on the fact that it's a motorist. And also it says that it's akin to a voluntary police citizen encounter. And so I think for those two reasons, Lidster does not legalize the stop of Mr. Curry, which is the question here, at all, for two distinct reasons, and certainly together, but I think either of them would
suffice. But the point is traffic checkpoints don't require individualized suspicion. It's a situation where the intrusion on the motorist is likely to be greater than having someone raise their hand. And yet those traffic checkpoints do not require individualized suspicion, but they require the cars to stop. They require the license to be displayed. They require registration to be displayed. There's an intrusion there, a greater intrusion than here. And there is no requirement of individualized suspicion under the Supreme Court's decision.
So, Your Honor, as an initial matter, my friend from the U.S. Attorney's Office has disclaimed raising special needs as its own exception. And also, I would disagree that having to remove your clothing is a lesser intrusion than stopping your car. Also, in SITS, it was a program set up in advance, unlike here, which is an ad hoc stop of a pedestrian. Frankly, Your Honor, the litigation strategy of the U.S. Attorney in this case, I think Judge Diaz, I think, recognized this earlier. They've waived the Terry appeal. I do not know why, but their strategy in this case, for whatever reason, is to do that. And so it's made the facts of this case a mismatch for what they've argued. And this case could have been resolved a different way, but for whatever reason, they've pursued one argument. It's that the exigent circumstances exception, as Judge Wynn was talking about, would allow for the stop and then frisk of anyone in the vicinity of a shooting. And that is contrary to Wardlaw. It is contrary to the entire line of Terry cases, including notably Florida versus JL. It's just never been allowed. And the government has the burden to show that a warrantless stop is constitutional. The district court ruled that they failed to show that, and we would ask this court to affirm. I'd also, if I can add one other point.
Let me just ask, I'm misunderstanding. Do the facts show that somebody had to take his clothes off? I thought they just raised their sweatshirt to see if there was a gun in the waistband.
Yeah, so revealing part of their body.
They didn't take anything off, right?
Yes, that's what I meant. Okay. It's revealing part of their body.
It has pulled up their shirt to show the waistband.
I don't think that's non-intrusive, Your Honor.
Okay. No, I'm just suggesting that the intrusion of taking off your clothes
correct.
Is a lot
It was not
different.
A strip search. Yeah. I apologize.
Not even taking off your clothes. Basically, just showing your waistband with a flashlight. It took less than a minute.
In the background, could you hear him saying, get down, get down?
Yes, Your Honor. The seizure was, video shows, the seizure was immediate on jump out of the car. If I could address also some of the questions to my colleague from the U.S. Attorney's Office. I made this point very clearly in the rehearing petition. This idea of a general reasonableness under the circumstances test for police action seems to be something that comes up quite a bit in Fourth Amendment cases. This question was presented squarely to the Supreme Court in Dunaway versus New York. I quoted the language at length in my rehearing petition. The court said, the government is asking us for an exception, I'm paraphrasing, that is reasonable police action under the circumstances. The Supreme Court, in a majority opinion for the court, rejected that request. The test is not reasonable police. That is not an exception. Reasonableness is not its own freestanding exception. The police action has to fall within an existing exception and be reasonable. So Dunaway sort of forecloses that avenue of argument from the U.S. Attorney's Office as well. So, if I may, in conclusion, as the Supreme Court held in Gantt, warrantless stops and searches are per se unreasonable, and the exigent circumstances doctrine has never allowed for suspicionless seizure of a person. The Terry Doctrine does allow for investigative seizures of persons, but the Department of Justice waived that argument. The United States here also does not argue that there was suspicion, whether as to Mr. Curry or to any of the other men in the field, but rather that suspicionless seizures should be allowed just in the vicinity of a recent crime. This is unprecedented. It's not within any understanding of the Fourth Amendment, whether originalist or common law. To quote the United States' own brief in Utah versus Streif, a police force's dragnet detention of members of a community on no suspicion, close quote, would be, open quote, a flagrant violation of the Fourth Amendment. So for those reasons, if there are no further questions, we would ask the court to affirm the district court's very careful and well-reasoned opinion.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Cook, you have some time reserved.
Mr. Cook, what would you say is your best case supporting you based on an exigent circumstances theory?
If I can, I'd like to answer that in two steps. The first step is there is a misunderstanding, I think, about from my friend about the basic analytical framework here. Her view is that the Supreme Court has never applied the factors from Brown in exigent circumstances cases. That's simply incorrect. The Supreme Court hasn't cited specifically Brown, but in Illinois versus MacArthur, there's two very short passages that I would direct the court to. First, Illinois versus MacArthur says, quote, that the case involves a plausible claim of specially pressing or urgent law enforcement need, i.e. exigent circumstances. So Illinois versus MacArthur, definitely an exigent circumstances case. The court then goes on to say, we balance the privacy-related and law enforcement-related concerns to determine if the intrusion was reasonable. That is a clear illustration of Brown balancing. And the court's analysis in that case, where they go on to say, well, look, there was strong evidence of a crime in the trailer, good reason to believe the defendant would destroy the evidence while they went for a warrant. They took reasonable steps to reconcile the balancing of government interests against the defendant's privacy interests because they just detained him for 2 hours, and so it was reasonable.
Okay, I'm sorry, but I would really like an answer to Judge Agee's question because that was my question too. And if you have two best cases, that's fine, but if you could just tell us, because the case you were describing doesn't sound very close to this one too, but it's your best case, that's fine. I'm prepared to write it down and look at it again.
No, so Illinois versus MacArthur is a case that establishes a legal principle that says, look, we're going to do this balancing test, and that's how analytically we're going to handle.
Are there any cases that we look to and we would say, yes, the government has to win here? That's what I want to know.
Right. And
this Illinois versus MacArthur, is that the case that we look to and we say the government has to win on these facts?
No, that's the case that tells you what
Okay,
test
well, what is the case
applying.
That tells us we win on you win on these facts?
In terms of what is the case once you've established the analytical framework on these facts, all of these cases, I will acknowledge, there is not a case that is just like this in terms of there is police response within 35 seconds to gunfire. This is,
well,
this
mean, these
is
are
not
better facts.
Yeah, how about one or two that you, obviously they're not going to be the same thing, but that it's the closest analogy we could draw.
Right. So Mora deals with this court's opinion in Mora is an exigent circumstances type case that deals with police response to imminent threat of injury to people, and it allows a police response. Again, as a matter of analytical principle, a case that Judge Wilkinson cited, Worden versus Hayden, which was decided in 1967, close in time to Terry, Justice Brennan endorsed in an exigent circumstances case that was dealing with danger. He said that the breadth of the police response in conducting a search in that case was as broad as may be reasonably necessary to prevent the dangers.
Mr. Cook, we've all, everybody in this room, or at least up here, has written briefs. And you know you can get language from a brief,
sure,
from a Supreme Court case that is helpful to you. And I'm not, this isn't a trick question. I really
right.
just want to be sure that I read the two, three cases that you think control here and make our decision here to reverse clear.
Right.
And so are Illinois versus MacArthur. Is that right? Mora and this Wheaton versus Hayden. Those are the cases?
Worden versus Hayden.
Worden versus Hayden.
There is not a case that is factually just like this.
Counsel,
I'm not
there's
going
never
to
a case
that.
That's factually like this. Let me just
right.
tell you. We have been doing this a long time. Some people here have been doing it even longer. There's never a case exactly like
it. Counsel, can I ask you, maybe just to refine the question, are there any cases, and again, I'm not trying to trick you or anything. I want to make sure I'm not missing anything. Are there any cases where the court applies exigent circumstances to allow a suspicionless search or seizure on a discretionary basis, not in sort of a roadblock situation where the police don't have discretion?
From this court, I think a case that is pretty helpful is Judge King's opinion in Figg. In that case, police were responding to gunfire that had occurred recently. They detained people who were not thought to be, per se, the shooters. They were being detained to create a safe environment in which people could conduct the investigation. As this court said, quote, faced with the need to conduct their investigation of the shooting incident in a reasonably safe environment, the initial half-hour detention of the Figs constituted a measured and proportionate response. I think that that applies equally here. Now, granted, it's different in that this is police arriving on the scene where they are trying to immediately address a danger that is unfolding in front of them. And in the same way that happened in Brigham City, that was a case where the police are responding to a fist fight.
Yeah, but there was suspicion. Dangerous. There was sort of an objective, articulable reason to go into that house and not some other house. So I'm really kind of stuck on this question of where there is neither individualized suspicion, you don't have that, and you also don't have something in the nature of a roadblock where it's happening to everybody on the scene. The police are deprived of discretion to pick and choose among citizens, basically to search based on a hunch that doesn't rise to the level of articulable suspicion. Are there cases like
right,
that?
Right, and
but it sounds like Figg is like that.
Figg is like that, okay. But I think that what is going on in this case is that you are, as the Supreme Court said in Illinois versus MacArthur, applying this balancing test. Because you have such a significant government interest here, which is preventing loss of life from a shooting that has just happened, the critical question is what steps are going to mitigate that danger to people on the scene using very limited intrusions, and figuring out who has the gun when they arrive in such a dangerous circumstance is really a tailored and narrow, and it was short in duration kind of response.
Well, Mr. Cook, it sounds like, over here.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Sounds like what you're saying then is that
if there are exigent circumstances, you don't need any articulable suspicion. Is that your proposition here?
No, I wouldn't go that far, and I think that's a really important point. So what has to be true in exigency is, rather than asking yourself about the question of who committed the crime as the ultimate issue, the issue is what is going to protect people and reduce danger. And in that scenario, where you have really dangerous circumstances, like this is even worse than a stabbing or a fistfight, there the question, what's going to protect people from loss of life and really serious harm, that's where the tailoring occurs. And this is why this test is going
to
work.
Counsel, so to help me understand, because that sounds like the special needs framework, right? That's saying that when you're applying the Brown test and you're looking at the government's interest as the first of the three things that you look at, what you've suggested to Judge Keenan, I gather, I'm just trying to interpret what you're saying, is that suspicionless flashlight search is appropriate here because it's not focused on catching the bad guy, but protecting the public safety. And that sounds like the special needs context, which I gather now that you've said you've abandoned. I'm just having trouble. It seems like you're importing that analysis into the first Brown factor as part of your exigency analysis. So they're connected. Maybe you're not relying on it as a distinct doctrine, but it seems to be incorporated in the first Brown factor for you. Is that right?
That is right, but let me clarify, if I may. So cases like Michigan's Tyler, which the police response to fire, are illustrating the point that under exigency doctrine, you are allowed to do things that protect people from serious injury. And so then you have this question about what's going to protect people from serious injury. And sometimes the answer to what is a reasonable measure is not going to turn on particularized suspicion. It's going to turn on what is a limited, reasonable measure to reduce the danger.
True, but exigency also, and Chief, I apologize. I know we wanted to finish quick, but exigency includes protecting people, but it also includes non-protecting people, right? Like the destruction of evidence. That, in some contexts, is a exigent circumstance. And it seems like to me you're trying to draw a distinction in the first prong of Brown analysis between the exigencies that protect human life, a public safety, and we can talk about the facts, but doctrinally, the exigency that protects public safety versus exigencies that are merely law enforcement, gathering evidence that might be destroyed as sort of a primary example. And you're distinguishing between those in the first prong of the Brown balancing test. And that distinction, it strikes me, is the very distinction that the court looks at in Lidster in distinguishing between a checkpoint that is focused on law enforcement objectives, that's Edmonds, a drug interdiction, versus a non-law enforcement interest, which the court in Lidster describes as information gathering or public safety. Right, that's the distinction you seem to be drawing. What am I missing?
So I think the key thing is to go and look at these exigency cases like Brigham City, and the court is saying that as a matter of applying the Brown balancing in the context of exigency doctrine, police are entitled to take steps to prevent loss of life. And then you just have to ask yourself what Justice Brennan said a long time ago. The police powers are as broad as may be reasonably necessary to prevent the danger. So the question this court is going to be asking itself in applying exigency to danger to people scenarios is what is reasonable to prevent the danger to the people. And in a shooting case, figuring out within seconds of the police arriving on the scene who is armed is a perfectly reasonable, in fact, the best thing the police could possibly do. And here they did it in a minimally intrusive way. I see that my time is up, unless the court has other questions.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. We'll ask the clerk to recess the court. We'll come down and greet counsel.
So
Honorable Court, we'll take a brief recess.